Obama meets the Pope at the Vatican today, Thursday, March 27th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. President Obama's approval ratings are pretty low. Maybe that's why he flew to Rome for talks with Pope Francis.
To meet this hugely popular leader with these incredibly high approval ratings, so hoping perhaps to bask in some reflected glory there.
Plus, elections are coming up in Turkey, and you don't want to be a candidate without your own van, roaming the streets blasting campaign songs.
Can you imagine an Obama van? For the Turkish audience, it's very normal.
Plus, remembering Cesar Chavez and his call to walk to Sacramento for farm worker rights.
What? You know, that guy is crazy. You know, we said maybe all the pesticides in the grapes has affected his brain. Now he wants us to walk, you know?
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, searching for runners who benefit from medical technology to run in the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon or Medtronic 10-mile run. Application and information available at medtronic.com/globalheroes.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. After a week of tough diplomacy in Europe, President Obama had a more relaxed meeting today with the Pope. The two men joked as they greeted each other at the Vatican. Talking about the pomp and ceremony, the president said, "His Holiness is the only person who has to put up with more protocol than me." Later, Obama described the meeting at a news conference.
You know, my day started with the great honor of meeting His Holiness Pope Francis. And like people around the world, I've been incredibly moved by his compassion, his message of inclusion. I was grateful to have the opportunity to speak with him about the responsibilities that we all share to care for the least of these, the poor, the excluded.
Despite the cordial tone, there are issues that divide Obama and Pope Francis. Reporter Jane Little specializes in religious affairs. First of all, Jane, what was the point of this meeting?
Well, the president is in Europe for this week-long visit. Of course, you know, it's a visit really dominated by the crisis over Crimea, but he hadn't met Pope Francis yet. He had met his predecessor, Pope Benedict. But Pope Francis, of course, probably the world's most popular leader right now. So, you know, he would have met the Pope anyway. These things happen when an American president goes to Europe. But I don't think it could have done him any harm. And I'm sure his advisors would say, actually, this might have some nice political brownie points in it for you to meet this hugely popular leader with these incredibly high approval ratings. Of course, the president's very low right now. So hoping perhaps to bask in some reflected glory there.
So they're reckoning that it's going to help Obama with his sagging popularity in the U.S. I mean, that seems like kind of getting this Pope gloss on Obama.
Well, that's always the case. We've seen it before with other presidents and other popes. But I don't think it was just a sort of political, cynical motive here at play. I think, you know, the feeling, the expression of warmth was genuine when President Obama talked of the great honor, being a great admirer of Pope Francis. I think that's true. I mean, if we recall, President Obama started his life as a community organizer, his working life as a community organizer in Chicago. His job was funded by the Roman Catholic Church. He was very much immersed in the world of the Catholic social gospel of the common good. And I think he sees in Pope Francis an ally in his plan to address inequality, the economic gaps between rich and poor. That's something Pope Francis has spoken out about a lot. So I think he'll be hoping Pope Francis will lend moral authority here.
How do you think the Pope benefits from this meeting?
The Pope gets to share with the most powerful leader of the non-religious world his message. He had a platform. He had 52 minutes here with him privately to talk about a wide range of issues. Of course, the Pope, even though he is the most powerful religious leader in the world, he's also under pressure from lobbyists on both sides within the church. And the American church is very, very split. So while progressives within the American Catholic Church would be very happy for him to talk about inequality, for him to continue his theme, which has really been very strong in his young papacy, attacking what he called the cult of money, the trickle-down theory of economics. In fact, some on the right have even called this Pope a Marxist. Progressives would be very happy with that theme being explored between the two men. But he was also under a lot of pressure from American Catholic bishops and those on the conservative end of the spectrum to talk abortion, to talk same-sex marriage, to talk about contraception, the so-called bedroom issues. And you'll remember it's quite a hot political issue because the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, included this mandate for employers to provide contraceptive coverage within their health insurance. And it's become, for some American bishops, a religious liberty issue. Of course, it made its way to the Supreme Court this week. So there are a lot of people out there complaining this president is against religious liberty. Some even say he's the most secular president on record. But there are also a lot of American Catholics happy with President Obama. So a very divided church trying to co-opt a pope, if you like, onto their side. But this pope is above American politics. You can't really say he's right or left in any understandable political terms.
I want to ask you about just the symbolism of these two modern world leaders together, the first president of color in the U.S. and the first pope from the Americas. How powerful is that for the flock?
It speaks volumes about a shift in the Catholic world, about a shift in the political world in America. Very, very symbolic. And I think even though there are points of strong disagreement between the Catholic Church and the Obama administration, on the other hand, there are many points of overlap, particularly on these economic issues. And the Pope wants this president, who has spoken on behalf of the middle class, to go even further and to speak on behalf of not just America's poor, but the world's poor, and to do something about it. And there, I think there's a sense that they might be fellow travellers of a sort, that they do both care about economic injustice and they do want to do something about the inequality gap.
Our friend, religious affairs reporter Jane Little, thanks as always.
Thank you, Marco.
Last week, Pope Francis made headlines when he condemned the mafia. He called on mobsters to stop doing evil or wind up in hell. The Pope had been speaking at a vigil for victims killed by the mafia. Now, you'd think that would be a normal thing to do for the leader of the Catholic Church, but Francis was actually the first pontiff to attend such a vigil. John Dickey is the author of Blood Brotherhoods, a history of organized crime in Italy. He says what Francis did last week was part of a long, slow process for the Vatican.
It's one of many signals over the last 20 years that the church is trying to make up for lost time. For, let's say, the first 150 years in the history of Italy's mafia organizations, the church was notable for its silence and even for its complicity with the power of organized crime. In the last 20 years, really since the moment in 1993, the turning point when Pope John Paul II denounced the mafia, became the first pope ever to use the word mafia, denounced the mafia in very angry terms in a speech in Sicily. Since that moment, there's been a kind of rupture between the mafia and the church, and the church has been doing a lot more, sending signals like this meeting.
I mean, give us some document examples of cooperation between the two organizations. How cozy has it been?
It's less a question of cooperation organizationally, if you like. I mean, certainly there have been, in Sicily, there have been priests who have been men of honour, have been initiated members of the mafia. The Sicilian Catholicism is very much based around the cult of the local saint and so on. And local priests were very happy all too often to allow the local mafia boss to walk in the front row of the parade on the saint's day, essentially to borrow the church's legitimacy, for the mafia to wrap itself in the church's clothes. At a higher level, at a more organizational level, the church essentially, during the Cold War, aligned itself with the West. And it aligned itself for that reason with the Christian Democrat Party, who were the pro-Western party and the Catholic party. Now, the Christian Democrats were profoundly infiltrated by the Sicilian mafia in the post-war era. Essentially, it led the church to making the mistake of assuming that anybody who opposed the mafia was a communist. There was a notorious cardinal archbishop of Palermo in the 50s and 60s, a man called Ernesto Ruffini, who famously said that the mafia didn't exist, that it was an invention by communists to besmirch Sicily. And that's that sort of thing the mafia obviously love to hear.
What has the mafia gotten out of this relationship with the church and with the pushback since Pope John Paul II? What have the mafia lost?
Well, we know that many bosses and affiliates from these organizations, you know, anecdotally watched John Paul's denunciation on television, can see priests taking a stance against the mafia, and at that point take a decision to turn state's evidence. The most shocking case was the priest, the local priest from the outskirts of Palermo, Pino Puglisi, who was shot in the face by two mafiosi in 1993 for taking a stand against them. He was beatified, and the man who shot him later reported that this priest turned to him and said, as he saw the gun pointed in his face, said, "I was expecting this." Mm. And the mafioso was so shocked by that demonstration of calm and courage that he decided to turn state's evidence. So that gives you an idea of the language that the mafia talks to itself. It may surprise you to learn, but in Italy, many, many mafiosi are religious. I mean, I made a program for Italian and British television about the bunkers that many mafia bosses hide out in these days, make for themselves underground command centres, effectively. And in absolutely every case, when the police finally discover these bunkers and break into them, there are statues, religious statues, there are crucifixes, there are Bibles and religious texts. Mafia bosses are religious.
John Dickey, professor at University College London, also the author of Blood Brotherhoods, A History of Italy's Three Mafias. Thanks so much.
Not at all.
Well, maybe the Pope's condemnation will inspire some mobsters to rethink their ways. A year into the job, Francis does have a reputation as an inspirational figure. We're going to hear next from one person who credits the Pope with renewing his faith. Facundo Silva, like Francis, is from Buenos Aires. He's a 39-year-old firefighter now living outside Washington, D.C. Silva's story starts with how, a year ago, he found out that he and the new Pope came from the same place.
I remember coming home and my girlfriend's kids were coming from the school, all excited that the Pope was, you know, the Pope is Argentine, the Pope is Argentine. That's what I remember hearing. And for me, it was a shock. I remember that same day downloading this book, you know, that now is being translated to, you know, many languages, but in English is Pope Francis, Conversations with Jorge Bergoglio. And that same night I read the book and, you know, I learned he was from the same neighborhood. We only grew up 4 blocks apart. He went to the same church. It was just one thing after the other one. You know, I felt like I was having the conversations with him. You know, that it felt that personal to me, and it made me, you know, made me want to be a part of that. You know, really, you know, it had that profound change, you know, in me. My grandparents were very Catholic, both on my mom and my dad's side. So as I became a teenager, I started questioning my faith, and, you know, it just grew deeper as I came to the United States and I became an adult. And I just, you know, for me, you know, a lot of things didn't make sense. It wasn't so much an issue with the church, but was more of a personal faith. I consider myself an atheist because I just didn't believe in God, and I was convinced that, you know, there wasn't a God. And the journey for me started the day that the Pope was elected. His cordial tone, it was just, he was so down to earth. When he says, "Who am I to judge?" I feel like he's talking to all of us. For me, it's like, here I am thinking about rejoining the church, you know, made that turn, made that change, and I'm starting to have faith again, and I'm enjoying the journey. But this is the beginning for me.
Facundo Silva, originally from Buenos Aires and now living near Washington, D.C. He spoke to reporter Richard Harris. This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic, searching for runners who benefit from medical technology to run in the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon or Medtronic 10-Mile Run. Application and information available at medtronic.com/globalheroes.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. For many Central American immigrants, the journey north to the United States involves a long and dangerous ride aboard a freight train in Mexico. That's the subject of a recent book called The Beast by Salvadoran writer Oscar Martinez. Danielle Alarcón, with our partners at Radio Ambulante, spoke with Martinez recently, and Danielle filled me in about him.
Oscar works for El Faro, which is one of the most respected online news outlets in Central America. And as a Salvadoran, I think he in particular was interested in the migration patterns that are happening and in that journey that many of his countrymen are taking north through Mexico. And I think he started coming across these stories and felt that someone had to tell them. The title in Spanish, I think, is pretty amazing. It's a little bit different from the English title. And I think it really gets to the heart of what this project was about. In Spanish, it was called Los Inmigrantes Que No Importan, the migrants that don't matter.
And in English, it's just called The Beast. Does that refer to what a lot of these migrants call the train?
Yeah, the train is called La Bestia because it is a kind of a savage, animalistic journey through kind of a forgotten part of Mexico, a lawless part of Mexico, places where there is no control and the law, it doesn't exist.
And Martinez has taken this train, and I want you to tell us what that actually means, to get on La Bestia.
Well, from talking with Oscar about it, I mean, it's exactly what the name implies. It's savage, it's dangerous. You're putting your life in God's hands when you step on that train. It's a cargo train, so the migrants run alongside and jump on. You know, there's no protection for them, and they're going through areas where they're being preyed upon by the authorities themselves or by different criminal bands, including the Zetas, you know, who deserve their pretty infamous reputation.
Yeah, and so given those life-threatening hazards, what did Oscar tell you about what motivates people to get on this train and go on this journey?
Well, you know, that's one of the things that I really loved about the book. You know, there's none of that romanticism of, oh, the journey northward and, oh, looking for a better life. You know, they're fleeing extreme poverty or extreme violence. And as Oscar Martinez told me, they just have to do it.
The Beast, it's like a chess game. If you make a bad movement, the consequences can be very rough. For example, there is a lot of people who lose legs and arms or the life on the train. There is a lot of dark scenes. When you see the reaction here, it's like if you are talking about Mars, something like that. It's like something so far, and it's not so far. Just in Los Angeles, there is 2 million of Salvadorian people. 2 million in one country that only lives 7 million of Salvadorian. I mean, mostly the half of my country live here in one city, in Los Angeles. For me, it's very shocking. I mean, it's people who is part of your life. And that people, a lot of that people, live across the hell before being here. For me, it's shocking.
Salvadoran writer Oscar Martinez speaking with Danielle Alarcón and our partners at Radio Ambulante. California has long attracted migrants, and those migrants have long toiled in the fields there under difficult conditions. That's what gave rise in the 1960s to the labor movement led by Cesar Chavez. There are several films coming out about him now, including one directed by Mexican actor Diego Luna, and they all feature the rural California town of Delano. It's where Chavez initiated his farm workers' rights campaign. Reporter Sasha Coca of station KQED toured Delano with some of the original Filipino and Mexican farm workers involved in Chavez's famous grape boycott.
And at the age of 11, I started working in the fields. And that's where I witnessed for the first time the injustice and the indignities suffered by the farm workers.
That's from the new film Cesar Chavez, starring Mexican-American actor Michael Peña as the labor rights leader. We see farm workers harvesting crops on bloodied knees and paying money to drink lukewarm water from a shared tin cup.
All we wanted was our basic rights.
Roberto Bustos says the film shows what he endured as a farm worker in the town of Delano in California's Central Valley and what convinced him and others to strike in 1965. He was 23 years old then.
The right to organize, you know, restrooms in the fields, clean, fresh, cold water, you know, and to be treated like human beings, period, you know.
Bustos points to what's now a Pentecostal church across from an alfalfa field. There's no sign marking this site, but it was the first union headquarters and where Chavez began his historic farmworker march in 1966.
And we thought he was talking about a caravan. He said, no, we're talking about walking. We're going to be marching to Sacramento. What? You know, that guy is crazy. Maybe all the pesticides in the grapes has affected his brain. Now he wants us to walk, you know?
And walk they did, with Bustos as captain of that march.
Man, blisters galore, you know. Well, we were marching in shoes, our Sunday shoes. We didn't know anything about marching.
A 340-mile pilgrimage started in Delano by 67 strikers concluded today on the steps of the state capitol.
Director Diego Luna wove old news footage into the movie. He made the film in Mexico and recreated sites in Delano, like the town's Filipino Hall. That's where Filipino and Mexican strikers came together. Lorraine Agtang was born in a Filipino labor camp in Delano. She was a teenager when Chavez led the massive strike against California grape growers. She says she's glad the film shows Chavez leading not just Mexican farm workers.
He's opened the door to the world for all of us, you know, who we were just little farm workers. I don't think I'd ever been outside of Delano. And to see the impact that actually the whole world supported the union. You know, everyone was not buying grapes. Pretty amazing.
The film also gets to what else brought Chavez international attention, his 25-day fast back in 1968. Chavez's son, Paul, shows me the adobe brick gas station where his father stayed during the fast.
I do not remember this room being so small and so barren. It's pretty stark.
There's just a single bed and a side table with a water pitcher. Paul was 11 when his father stopped eating.
It's a scary feeling to see somebody you love become weaker by the day and knowing that, you know, that they could just start eating and it would be okay and not understanding why he wouldn't eat, you know. But yeah, as I got older, I understand the importance of sacrifice and penance.
So far, Diego Luna's film is being criticized for making Cesar Chavez look one-dimensional and saintly. Paul Chavez, who says he weighed in heavily on the film's script, disagrees.
We want to make sure that we don't put my father up on a pedestal so that we make him larger than life and that people think that there's only once in a lifetime that a Cesar Chavez comes. You know, if there was anything to learn from my father's example is that he was a regular person. He never owned a car, never owned a house, and he showed us that regular, ordinary people could do extraordinary things.
But if you ever make it to Delano, you can't just pull up and actually see a museum or mural dedicated to Chavez. There is a national monument at Chavez's later headquarters about an hour away. But in Delano, the town's only museum features replicas of old buildings and farm tools. For The World, I'm Sasha Coca, Delano, California.
You can go on a photo tour of Delano at PRI.org, and tomorrow we'll hear how the town has changed since Chavez's time and how residents there are trying to recognize his history. This is PRI. I'm Marco Werman. Ahead on The World, we introduce you to Daryl Middleton, the globetrotting American who became a star in Spain's professional basketball league. Now the former power forward is introducing Spanish palates to American desserts.
Carrot cake is like the most famous. Lemon meringue pie, pecan pie, they go nuts. They act like it's crack.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, searching for runners who benefit from medical technology to run in the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon or Medtronic 10-Mile Run. Application and information available at medtronic.com/globalheroes.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Being a journalist in Russia often means working, directly or indirectly, for the government. The Kremlin controls most major media outlets in the country. That leads to self-censorship in many cases. And those who publish or air stories critical of the government often suffer from harassment or intimidation. Last week, someone we've spoken with several times on the show, journalist Natalia Antonova, stepped down from her position at the Moscow News. After 4 years as an editor there, her decision to leave was a difficult one, but she says the paper, which has been temporarily shuttered, was changing and not in a good way.
the parent agency of the Moscow News, RIA Novosti, which was Russia's best and biggest news agency, was liquidated by a presidential decree. And the person who is going to head the new news agency that is being created, that's Dmitry Kiselyov. A lot of people in the West have now heard of him because he actually appeared to threaten nuclear holocaust against the United States on Russian national TV the other day. And wow. He's actually, it's true. He's tasked with running this news agency that is supposed to create a very positive image of Russia abroad and to kind of bring the message home that Russia is, as he put it, an important country with good intentions.
So RIA Novosti is Kremlin funded. So does that now mean that the Moscow News is also Kremlin funded and lacking editorial independence?
We were Kremlin funded before, but we were never told, well, you can write this, but you can't write that. We never had problems like that. Now, for their state money, they want to see something very different, and it's not the kind of product that we were making.
Now, Natalia, you wrote an impassioned blog post about your decision to leave, and in it you said, what's especially hard to accept is that with regard to Ukraine, nothing may ever be the same again. It's a scary, painful time, and it's almost bizarre to observe how the stuff of headlines and news reports also has to do with your family and fate. Explain that last bit.
I'm originally from Kiev. I was born there. I grew up in the States, but that's where most of my family still is. Just looking at my own family, I'm very worried because people have become very polarized, whether pro-Russia or against Russia. It just seems that there's lots of turmoil, and it does affect me personally. It affects my relatives, my friends, the people I've known since I was a very small child. You know, we're not sure how it's going to go. I mean, it could all turn out fine, or there could be like a huge bloody mess on our hands. And I'm really hoping that we'll avoid the latter scenario.
I mean, at the very least, it sounds like what happened in Crimea and Ukraine, it's kind of forced your focus off journalism, at least for the short term, and onto Ukraine and this crisis.
I am going to Kiev in a few weeks to be with my family, and also, no, because they're canceling my visa, so I have to leave.
Why did Russia cancel your visa?
It's nothing personal. It's just that when you leave your job and you're here on a work visa, they have to cancel it. It's over, and now you have to look for another job, find a new visa, or, you know, find work in another country. I think I would prefer to go back to working in Russia because I kind of, you know, I see it as a very interesting place. In spite of all the latest turmoil and all the scary stuff that's been happening lately, it's still a really cool place.
Russia is a cool place, as you say, to cover because it's so interesting. But how would you describe the atmosphere there right now?
Well, Vladimir Putin's approval rating is very high right now. It's over 80%. Lots of people are really excited about Crimea. There's also the fact that I think the Russian economy has been really fragile, that the government is turning people's attention away from internal issues and kind of focusing externally and saying, well, you know, we're going to take Crimea and there's all these enemies out there to get us. You know, it plays well for a domestic audience. So it's kind of a moment of triumph. Whether or not that feeling of euphoria will last, I don't know.
Journalist Natalia Antonova speaking with us from Moscow. She recently left her position as editor of the Moscow News. Thanks very much, Natalia.
Thank you.
A key presidential election is just over a week away in Afghanistan, and the Taliban are vowing to disrupt the vote. Their campaign of violence is well underway. This week in Kabul, suicide bombers and gunmen attacked an office of the Afghan Election Commission. Two police officers were killed, along with two election workers. Foreign observers are in the country preparing to monitor the election, but some of them have left because of the violence. Faisal Ali Khan just returned from a month-long trip to Afghanistan. He's a fellow with the New America Foundation in Washington. So you were traveling around in Afghanistan, talking with people. What were they telling you about the upcoming election?
There was a lot of excitement that I've found from people, whether it was, you know, youth that was very involved or people in the administration, local people. There was a lot of activity going on. I think it's something that sprung everybody back into hope, and they're looking towards a better future for themselves.
Are people scared for their safety with all this violence going on?
You know, people are very cautious, but I think in Afghanistan, the feeling that people have towards elections is there's an expectation of there being a certain amount of violence that's taken place always historically. So I don't think it's as much of a shock to them, you know, as it may be to some of the foreign observers.
So you spoke with a lot of different people, a real wide range. I'm curious to know, first of all, the difference between the attitudes toward this election in the cities, let's take Kabul, for example, and out in the countryside. How are people seeing it differently?
That's a very good sort of point there. I mean, in the cities, a lot of the younger people, which dominate the media, which dominate, you know, the interlocutors between the foreign troops and diplomats, media, etc., their vision of the country is quite different from the parts in the south. I think when you go down into the South, because of the level of education, because of the tribal dynamic, because of so many other factors, there's a very different expectation, thinking, and the way that they see themselves also being somewhat removed from the center. But in both places, I must say, there was a fair level of enthusiasm. People were excited. It's also, you know, gives people something to look forward to and something to do, something that's positive and something that unites people.
What about that? I mean, it's interesting, the rural-urban split, what you're saying, it sounds like it also defines a youth-elder split. What will that mean in this election? I mean, what are the big concerns of the youth that maybe the elders aren't getting?
I've always felt that the intergenerational aspect to this conflict is something that's really never been addressed. There's no suicide bomber over 20 years old. There's no hardly any militant commanders or even Taliban leaders about 25 years old or so. There are no tribal leaders who are less than 50, 60, you know, 70, that sort of thing. And in the culture, they don't really engage with younger people or allow them to become part of the public debate. And so it's really these anti-state groups or militant groups which help shape the perception or interpret events for the younger people. The mainstream candidates are trying to reach out to them. I saw all the campaign managers being in their 30s of all of these candidates, and the candidates, even some of the old faces that you see, trying to reach out more to women and to younger people, which is something that's been quite different in the past.
Faisal, you're from Pakistan, and many Afghans, as you know, accuse Pakistan of providing a safe haven for some of the militants that carry out attacks in Afghanistan. That must have made for some interesting conversations when you were there.
I've never felt this sort of anti-Pakistan sentiment before in any place that I've visited, particularly amongst, which is surprising, amongst the young urbanized youth in Kabul, more so than when I went out into the rural areas.
But you felt it on this trip?
Absolutely. I mean, some of my movement was restricted, not because so much of security reasons that I felt, but it was people weren't willing to associate with me or to be seen with me. And people that I knew well, particularly those in politics, they said, look, the last thing we need is a Pakistani to be trailing around with us and people to sort of draw conclusions from that about us being supported or, you know, this sort of thing. So they're very, very aware of it. There's a lot of animosity. But when you get under the surface, you find that it's more directed towards, you know, the government or the state as opposed to the people. So it's almost like they need that time to sort of just berate you and then they sort of, you know, calm down.
Yeah. Well, even if it's about the government, what kind of confidence does that give you for the future of Afghanistan, regardless of who becomes the next president?
I think it really is a challenging relationship because there's very little people-to-people interaction. There have been trips by the Afghan parliament to Pakistan, but on the civilian side, we don't have any correspondence there from our media. We have over 82, you know, private channels. They have about 50 channels or so. There's no correspondence on theirs, on our side. So there's very little that we actually know about each other on a people-to-people basis. And in terms of a future, unless we have this relationship of equality, where there's a respect for the sovereignty of both countries and we look at each other in a state-to-state relationship and build more people-to-people ties, it's going to be a real challenge for both of us. For Pakistan at the moment, we have our own sort of existential threat from these anti-state movements in our country. It's a matter of our survival. So I think there's a common theme that we have between the two countries. And, you know, I foresee that there will be a positive future because of some of the common problems we face.
Faisal Ali Khan, a fellow at the New America Foundation. He's just back to Washington after a month-long trip to Afghanistan. Thanks so much, Faisal.
Thank you very much.
Elections are coming up in Turkey, too. Much sooner, though, on Sunday, Turks are voting for their local governments. The run-up to the vote has been tense, as the central government has moved to try and shut down first Twitter, now YouTube. But the campaigning goes on, and in Turkey, it's done a bit differently. One of the ways political parties there try to get their voters pumped is through song. Here's more from Dalia Mortada in Istanbul.
It's election season in Turkey, and along with the posters and the flutter of campaign flags come vans decked out in political party colors and candidate pictures blaring songs like this one. Mehmet Ali Tutan is a professor in political science at Istanbul's Bilgi University.
You hear, oh yes, Recep Tayyip, that reminds them, for the AKP electorate, for example, I need to support my leader, Tayyip Erdogan.
Tutan says songs like the one for the ruling Justice and Development Party, or the AKP, are a cheap, effective way to get attention. You don't need to tell Uğur Işılak that. He's a famous musician and a longtime fan of the Prime Minister. He wrote the lyrics to this Erdogan election song.
Dedik ki, Tayyip Erdoğan'ın üzerine çok gidiliyor. İnsanlar partinin üzerine gitmiyor.
Öcalan says the song's focus is Erdoğan because it's Erdoğan who's been under attack lately, not the AKP. Alleged phone calls linking the prime minister to corruption are fake, Öcalan insists, and he wants to show that Turkey stands by its leader. That's why it had to be about Erdoğan, he says. Göründüğü gibi olan gücünü milletten alan Recep Tayyip Erdoğan. A polished studio version of the song is available online. It tells the tale of a leader loved by millions, trusted by his people, and a nightmare to his enemies. The lyrics play on Erdoğan's image as a tough, no-nonsense leader. But other parties are singing a different tune. Take the main opposition, known as the CHP. Şu dünyadaki en mutlu kişi, mutluluk verendi. In a viral YouTube campaign, CHP candidates sing a song that says essentially, "Can't we all get along?" It's a cute video and a happy tune, with no mention of the party's leader.
By their choice of the song, they are also giving a message. We are peaceful. We are applying to the general society.
These examples of how political parties in Turkey rally their base are from two of the largest factions. Turkey has dozens of political parties, and most of them have songs. One Kurdish party's song refers to the Kurds and the opposition in general, coming out of the shadows. The National Movement Party is pushing a rap song called Raise Your Voice, which rattles off a list of the government's ills. Tutan chuckles when he compares the Turkish style of campaigning with what Americans are used to.
Can you imagine an Obama van? For the Turkish audience, it's very normal. Oh yes, it's the Obama van.
Tutan says one thing is similar about U.S. and Turkish campaigning. Much like the incessant TV ads in the U.S., Turkish jingles aren't likely to change any votes, but they could help energize the electorate. For The World, I'm Dalia Mortada in Istanbul.
I've got one more election note before we take a break. This one from the mayoral race in Toronto. Campaigning cranked up big time there last night. Headline-making Mayor Rob Ford is running for re-election, and last night he and the other four main candidates sparred in a live televised debate. The mayor of Canada's largest city is known less for his policies than he is for, well, where'd he start? Drug use, drunkenness, and erratic behavior. Last night, at various points in that TV debate, things got a little heated and pretty chaotic.
We heard here an admission from Mayor Rob Ford.
Yep. That should clear things up for Toronto voters. The candidates took verbal jabs at each other, but there was a surprising omission in the attacks on Mayor Ford. Not one of his opponents mentioned the video recorded last year that appeared to show Rob Ford smoking crack cocaine. They mostly opted to attack him on local issues, his plans for a subway, unemployment, and, okay, the disruption that his personal issues have caused at City Hall. So polite, so Canadian. And with the candidates tiptoeing around Ford's foibles, it was left to talk show host Jimmy Kimmel, south of the border, to take a couple of shots at the mayor in his opening monologue last night.
Maybe this is the difference between our countries. None of the other candidates specifically mentioned drugs. They let Mayor Ford say over and over again he's the only candidate with a proven track record, even though he's also the only candidate with a proven crack record. That did not... Over the course of 90 minutes, the word crack was mentioned one time, and it was by a reporter, not by any of his opponents, which, I don't know, how's that possible? Do I have to do everything for you people?
Insults for export, courtesy of Jimmy Kimmel. Voters in Toronto go to the polls in October.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, a brain training program designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 50 million people worldwide. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It's Sweet 16 time for March Madness. Among the matchups tonight, Baylor versus Wisconsin. Our next story features a former Baylor power forward who wound up playing pro basketball in Europe. He's retired now, but the world's Jerry Haddon found him in Alicante on Spain's Mediterranean coast.
The story of how 47-year-old Darryl Middleton, originally from Queens, New York, arguably the most successful hoops player in European League history, ended up in this quiet beach town is, well, pretty amazing. It starts in the 1980s with a tall 15-year-old kid too shy to even touch a basketball.
New York City is different because you have people watching the game, 100, 200 people at the park because people are always talking trash. And so it's kind of tough. I never understood how can people play with the people watching. That's what I couldn't understand.
But when his older brother finally convinced him to just try, he says he instantly loved the game. Pretty soon, Middleton became a star high school forward, ditto later at Baylor University. The Atlanta Hawks drafted him. Life was good, he thought.
The Hawks was a bad choice. I mean, I got picked by the wrong team. They had a lot of good players in my position. So it wasn't make no sense for me to go there and get cut.
Meanwhile, his agent was whispering in his ear, Turkey.
Turkey. I went to Turkey. I didn't know they played basketball in Turkey.
He says it was a tough first 3 months in Istanbul.
But I had a good coach. You know, he took care of me. He put me under his wings, treated me like a son, and that helped. But he made it much easier for me, and I think that's why I'm still here today, you know, for that coach.
What was his name?
Coach Uner.
As if life hadn't gotten strange enough, something weirder happened. Middleton fell in love with his life abroad and quickly forgot about the NBA. He went to play in Rome next and never looked back.
I went to Spain, seven years maybe. Then I went to Greece, to Athens, and then back to Russia, and then back to Spain. I've been around.
For 25 years, Middleton reigned over European hoops, averaging near 30 points a game most seasons, taking home several MVP awards, earning a good living. It took a toll on his personal life, though. He divorced early on. His wife went back to the U.S. with their three daughters.
Kids grown, and it's just sad I didn't see them grow up, you know? That's the only part I kind of miss, you know? Didn't see them go to school, blah, blah, blah, you know? But they understand, you know?
Family aside, Middleton has had an extraordinary run. He finally retired last year, injury-free, at the unheard-of age of 46. You might think he'd have considered returning home then, but no.
I miss my family, friends, my kids. I like it. I like it here.
You know? What do you like about it? What did you got?
The food. I don't want to go back to the States. You go back to the States, too much fast foods.
Food, in fact, is Middleton's future now. In November, he opened this posh eatery just off the beach called Gastrocomia. On a recent day, it's packed at lunchtime. That same night, it's closed, but Middleton invites me in for dinner, shows me around the kitchen.
You're going to enjoy this meal. It'll be the best meal you ever had.
The best meal I've ever had. Call it culinary confidence. Middleton cooks everything he serves and makes the drinks.
The man is putting strawberries in a gin tonic.
And dry ice, I think. The glass smokes and bubbles.
Do I drink it while it's bubbling like
that? No, you can drink like that.
Yeah, yeah. I'm
good. It's going to go to your nose, so you got to hold your breath.
Woo!
Until you get used to it.
Wow, that wakes you up, huh?
Yeah.
Delicious.
Crazy, yeah.
Then on to dinner. Middleton whips up a salmon and crab salad laced with little white worm-like eels, fried. The main course, Parmesan sea bass on a bed of lobster potatoes. Middleton shares the key to his success overseas, being different. He was different on the court, stronger, faster, more disciplined. And he's different in the kitchen, especially when it comes to the desserts he makes.
Carrot cake is like the most famous. People love to go nuts for the carrot cake. Lemon meringue pie, pecan pie, they go nuts. They act like it's crack. Hey, no, sir. You laugh, man. I'm telling you.
Their eyes
kind of
go funny.
Yeah. I don't know if it's that corn syrup.
It's a good life, Middleton says over a slice of carrot cake. Most of the memories are good ones. You can hear it in his voice.
Crazy. I had some crazy experience in Greece, man. You got 20,000 Greeks in the stand doing layup line.
For the world, I'm Jerry Haddon, Alicante, Spain.
Now I want pecan pie. Okay, from hoops to discs now. Let's get right to today's DJ pick.
I'm Tom Schnabel from radio station KCRW in Santa Monica, California. There's a new album by Bossa Cucanova. The name sounds very Brazilian. It doesn't really mean anything. It's just a fun word. It's called Our Kind of Bossa. The group was founded 15 years ago by Marcio Menescal, the son of the famous other Menescal, Roberto Menescal, who's one of the founders of Bossa Nova. Their aim was to modernize and refresh Bossa Nova with new beats and ideas. The new album samples some Brazilian classics and adds some tasty twists. Also has a great guest list of performers. The first track is called Adios America, Farewell America. It's a track about a carioca, a resident of Rio, who's in America and who wants to get back to Brazil. Eu digo adeus ao boogie-woogie, ao oogie-boogie e ao swing também. Chegar de rocks, fox, trots, hipnots, que isso não me convém. Tô chegando. Adeus America, or Farewell America, from Bossa Cucanova's new album, Our Kind of Bossa. Here's a track called Deixe a Menina. It means let the girl be. The song was penned by the great songwriter Chico Buarque. This is about a guy who's very jealous of his woman, who's out dancing samba with a lot of other guys. Can't say I blame him. The lyrics tell him to just chill out, let her be happy, and dance.
Não é por estar na sua presença, meu prezado rapaz, mas você vai mal, mas vai mal demais. São 10 horas, o samba está quente. Deixa a morena contente. Deixa a menina sambar em paz. Não queria jogar confete, mas tenho que dizer: cê tá de lascar, ah, cê tá de doer. E se vai continuar enrustido com essa cara de marido, a moça é capaz de se aborrecer. Por trás de um homem triste há sempre uma mulher feliz. Atrás dessa mulher, meu homem sempre tão gentis. Por isso, para o seu bem, ou tire ela da cabeça, ou mereça a moça que você tem.
Deixe a Menina, from Bossa Cucanova. The track means Let the Girl Be. Bossa Cucanova's new album celebrates the classics while putting a contemporary spin on them. The album is filled with energy and ingenuity.
Thank you, Tom Schnabel. Again, the album is called Our Kind of Bossa, already on my must-get list. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for being with us.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org, by the Annenberg Foundation, and by the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, and by the PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.